Rolling again. Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today I talk with Cedar Van Tassel, whose book Apple Guy and Beefwood was published last month by the iconic... Did you just laugh?
Sorry, I was trying to keep it a cough.
That can be an outtake. That can be the little teaser bit. Sorry. At the very beginning. Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today I talk with Cedar Van Tassel, whose book Apple Guy and Beefwood was published last month by the iconic Montreal Comics publisher Drawn and Quarterly, which calls the book a serial buddy comedy in the classic Calvin and Hobbes tradition that uses rural agriculture as a stepping off point as he tackles issues like climate change, small town politics, psychedelics, mysticism, and friendship. There's something delightfully esoteric about this comics collection, which unpacks the idiosyncrasies of life at a granular level, kind of like the old TV sitcom Seinfeld, only with a rural setting and a lot more science allusions. I think my wife Kiki will attest that this book made me laugh out loud about every four pages. Now, if the name Cedar Van Tassel sounds familiar, it's because Cedar is the guy who's been editing and producing this podcast for the past several years. In fact, the reason that I'm reading this intro live right now is because Cedar is going to have to edit it later for me when the interview is done. You might recall that Cedar wrote the Deviate podcast theme music back when he was 17 years old. Cedar is, in fact, my nephew, and I've been collaborating on him on projects since he was a kid. Cedar did the illustrations from my book Souvenir, which came out in 2018, and 3 years before that, he did the art from my travel comic book, The Misadventures of Winnemann, which is a graphic adaptation of the oldest literary tale known to man. As a matter of fact, I have free copies of the Winnemann comic for the first 10 people who buy Cedar's new Apple Guy book and mail me the receipt at deviate@rolfpotts.com. Cedar and I will both sign that comic and mail it for free in any place in the United States. If you live outside the U.S., he'll have to charge you a little bit of postage, but I can clarify that by email. For now, Cedar, let's have a conversation. Does that sound good to you?
Yep.
All right.
Sounds great.
You sent me four pieces of advice in anticipation of this interview. It's one, be opportunistic. Two, give yourself some rules. Three, don't torture yourself. And four, people will find your interest in something interesting. So over the course of this conversation, some of those things will come out, but we'll come back full circle at the end of the interview and talk about those factors that can enable a creative life on your own terms.
Yeah.
If that's a good way of putting it.
Sure.
But let's talk about how, what your background is. I mean, I've known you since you were 0 years old. You edit this podcast, you do the theme music for this podcast. We've been collaborating for a very long time, but I want to call you out on one thing very early in the interview, and that's I have audio evidence of you at age 3 declaring that you wanted to be a paleontologist. Let's roll that right now, Cedar.
So what do you call that kind of, what do you want to be when you grow up?
A paleontologist.
All right. And what does a paleontologist do?
Work for bones.
Look for bones. All right.
Okay, so what happened? Why are you not a paleontologist right now?
That's a great question. Well, I think that at some point I realized that there is a lot more cultural reference to paleontologists than there are paleontologist job openings. I feel like this was maybe something that was even expressed to me by my parents at a relatively young age. They maybe tried to, I mean, I think they were supportive of, I think they were glad that I was, interested in a scientific field, but I feel like there was some talk about how this was actually sort of like, it's kind of like one of those magical jobs that kids want to have, like being an astronaut, where it's like there's like 15, you know, employed astronauts,
right?
No, in the US.
If you interviewed every boy at age 3, including myself at age 3, like 90% of them would want to be paleontologists,
right?
Or astronauts, or maybe professional sports players.
Right. I think also as a kid, you do not realize that most of paleontology is like brushing dust off of like, you know, you're like brushing dust off of 1,000 things, and like on the 1,000th thing, it's actually a dinosaur bone or like a tiny fragment of a dinosaur bone. I mean, honestly, I think really what I wanted to do was be the person that drew the dinosaurs in the books, you know, like that would look at the bones and then like draw the illustration of the dinosaurs.
Well, actually, in the interview that we have audio of, you're talking about what dinosaurs look like, and you talk about how they have blue teeth, you talk about what they eat, you talk about how big they are. We can run some more audio right now.
And so all of dinosaurs have blue teeth.
Cedar, can you tell us what this dinosaur eats?
Fish.
And basically, you have a lot of confidence in your expertise about the dinosaur at that age. But at some point, things pivoted. I know that you were drawing dinosaurs at age 3, but by age 4, I was living in Asia, and you sent me a book that you wrote. Actually, your mom sent it to me. You drew the pictures, but you couldn't write yet. And so it was 4 pages long, and this is the entirety of the book. Page 1. A boy looked into a microscope, and his daddy asked what he saw. He said he saw God. Page 2. A boy was walking in Bethlehem. God was alive, and the boy bumped into him, and God jumped on him. Page 3. A boy was in a dot. God stepped on a dot, and the boy popped out of the dot. And God said, "No, stay in the dot." Page 4. Once upon a time, there was a man that was poor. He saw God walking. The man asked for money, and God said, you'll have to find your own money. You'll have to find your own money. So I think this has some things in common. Like, there's some sort of theological existential issues going on in Apple Guy and Beefwood.
Well, and it's four pages, 4 panels.
Oh, that's true.
It's kind of like, yeah.
Right? You might have to do a retro. It's just so my listeners know that your comic, your new book, consists of 4 panel comics.
Right.
But it feels like you were sinking your teeth into some pretty heady stuff back then. Obviously, maybe it was around Christmas time or something. You've been thinking about God and Bethlehem. And I think your scientist father was sort of trying to explain, you know, that God isn't necessarily this anthropomorphic creature. It could be like a molecule. What's a molecule? Well, it's a dot. But then you probably also knew from church that God could be sort of punitive sometimes. And so you have this really, really strangely existential, biblical book that you wrote at age 4. So this is, I guess, your second book in a certain sense.
Right, right.
And then suddenly started writing comics. But I'm curious to know what kind of comics you read and where. Like, you were born in 1999. Are you old enough to remember comics in paper newspapers?
Yeah. I mean, your mom, my grandma, would get the paper, the Salina Journal. Mm. And I mean, I would read the comics page like every single day. Like, I'd read through all the comics, even the ones that I knew at that age to be like really bad, you know.
Okay. Right. You took pleasure in the fact that there were comics. See, and just so my listeners know, you would come home from school, you would come to your grandma's house.
Right.
Because your mom was working. And so you would hang out with your Nana and you would read the funnies, which is a tradition that, and this is interesting because your comics are in that tradition, right?
For sure.
They're sort of the 4 panel newspaper style comics.
For sure.
In an age when people just don't read paper newspapers like they did before.
Right.
So do you trace your inspiration back to that, or to like that Calvin and Hobbes anthology that you got for Christmas that year? What were your influences?
The Calvin and Hobbes anthology, 3 volume, giant.
Right.
Like, it weighs like 30 pounds or something.
Right.
Like, we got that for Christmas. Luke and I, my brother, got that for Christmas. And we like immediately like binged, I think, as much of it. I mean, it took us like maybe a month or something, or several months, to read through everything.
How did you know about Calvin and Hobbes? Was he in the Salina Journal? Was that in the Salina Journal?
Or no. Calvin and Hobbes was not in the Salina Journal.
Okay, interesting.
The Salina Journal did not have any comics that were as good as Calvin and Hobbes. It was almost all bad comics.
Wow. It's probably what they could afford.
I think we always had a few like anthology newspaper comic books floating around.
Mm-hmm.
But even I remember when I mean, we would go to the library all the time as like a daycare, you know, just like a place for kids to go. Mm-hmm. And we would read the comics. And my parents would also, I would read comics before I could read. Mm-hmm. So I would spend like hours looking at comics, all newspaper comics, before I could mm-hmm. read. And mm-hmm. either my parents would read them out to me.
Right.
Or I would just look at them.
Right.
And so like, I would like try to figure out what the joke was, you know, without being able, I have right. this memory of like trying to figure out what the joke was without reading the text. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then later, after I learned how to read, reading the text and being like, oh, the joke wasn't what I thought it was at all. You know,
right.
I mean, there's also the same thing, like when you reread at different ages, anything, like reading through Calvin and Hobbes when I was 5 versus reading through it when I was 12 versus reading through it when I was 15. And then like I totally misunderstood a lot of the jokes because that is a comic for adults,
right,
really.
Right.
The pictures in it, like, I guess I should say like it's kind of half and half. Probably half of the comics in Calvin and Hobbes are for adults. And the other half are like more visual, kind of like, you know, Calvin makes a snowman monster, which like, you right. know, eats Susie or something. And it's right. like, that's awesome as a kid, you know. And the other big thing was that we didn't have TV.
Right.
And so we would just like, that is like, that was scratching the same itch for us, for me, as a TV, because it's visual and language, you know.
Yeah, jumping ahead a little bit, I remember that sort of made you a curiosity here in rural north central Kansas, that your high school newspaper wanted to do a story about you and your brother not having a television. This is like this is like important news.
It was about us not having a TV and also not having a dryer.
So living a perfectly normal rural life, you know, in the 1950s or the 18 or 50s,
yeah,
was this bizarre thing in the yeah. 2010s, I guess.
Right.
I remember, as one's uncle does, trying to encourage certain kinds of comics. I think I bought you a Scott McCloud book.
Sure. Yeah.
I forget, what is it called? Understanding Comics or something?
There's Understanding Comics and then there's Making Comics.
Okay. Right. So, what were, as you started to draw your own, certainly you were drawing comics before you ran into the Scott McCloud books. What were your influences as a craftsman, both theoretically and just sort of DIY?
Yeah, I mean, I think like the first like real comics I drew was in second grade or third grade. I would draw one called Potato Warriors, which was this sort of it was all like physical comedy, you know?
Okay.
And it was all about these potato warriors that had like sunglasses and mohawks and stuff. They were like bikers. They were like my like strange, like amalgamation of bikers and punks or something.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
But then they would fight with the hot dog ninjas.
Sounds awesome.
It was great. And somewhere there's like 200 pages of this, but I don't have it.
Wow.
It's like my friend at the time in third grade and I would do these every single day. But then, yeah, as far as like honing my craft or whatever, I mean, you're always just like emulating what you see, mm-hmm. you know, that's like the first sort of instinct, you know.
It's an old human tradition. It's
right.
It's weirder not to do that.
Right. And I remember like just, When you're younger, your mind is so eager to fill itself up, I guess. Like, mm-hmm. like I remember reading a book on how to draw the Simpsons characters without ever watching The Simpsons.
Because you didn't have a TV.
Because I didn't have a TV. Well, eventually, I did watch The Simpsons. But right. at the time I wrote this book, it was like a step-by-step guide about how to draw like the Simpsons exactly how they
look. Okay, right.
Yeah. You know, like how to size the eyeballs and like Homer's eyeball is like his stomach, like you draw it as a big circle and it's exactly 4 eyeballs wide or something like that. And I was like studying this book, you know, like really closely, like this is just what you have to do, you know, like to draw characters, like everything has to, it's like drafting or something, you know, and like, and then eventually, yeah, I mean, I read those Scott McCloud books, mm-hmm. and we started, you know, making some, you started writing stuff and I started doing the comics.
Right. When I'm on comics, I did a memoir of my own life that you illustrated. I think it was about my own life at age 14. You were 14, so I made you do some comics about my life. You started a series called, I think you bought a domain, Comic Nuggets?
Right.
Remember Comic Nuggets?
Yeah, that was when like web comics, I guess that's another aspect of this, is that I started reading web comics when I started having more reliable internet connection. But I remember reading web comics at the computer that was right here.
Right.
In the office that we're recording in.
Formerly my father's office, now my office.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But I learned about web comics and started getting really into those, and then I wanted to make my own.
But you were drawing, I know at a certain point you transitioned from pencil and paper to like an iPad or something?
Right. Like, I mean, at that time, that was actually kind of somewhat influenced by that Scott McCloud book. Hmm. Like, it was sort of a utopian time almost, like that period. It was like the ability to draw straight into the computer was becoming like easier and easier. Like, I think it used to be very, very expensive to do that. Mm-hmm. And then they were coming out with more the tablets that you could draw on sort of remotely. Mm-hmm. And then eventually the iPad, which was like, you could draw on directly on the screen.
Right.
And so at that time it seemed like that was the only way that comics were ever going to be drawn from there on out.
Huh.
And it felt like I had to like, I felt like I had to get used to it and like
to the computer style.
Yeah, like that's just like the way everyone was, and web comics were so big at that point too, and everyone there, you know, it was faster to do it straight onto the computer than do it on paper and scan it.
Will you make it seem like, are web comics no longer a thing?
No, they're definitely a thing.
Uh-huh.
But I think actually there was, I mean, comics historians probably have written about this. I think there actually was a boom when you could make more ad revenue off of running your own website, if that makes sense. Like before the total like monopolization of social media.
Okay.
Where you could actually like, I mean, kind of like blogging, you know, where you could actually make a living off of clicks on your website.
Right.
And people were going to different websites to get their webcomics instead of all going to Instagram.
Gotcha.
Or all going to Reddit or something like that.
Well, I want to eventually go towards the technological aspect of this and like how AI might change things. But it's interesting that like blogging is sort of seen as a golden age of sorts. Mm-hmm. But at the time seemed very cutting edge, mm-hmm. but is now seen as sort of this age of innocence, I mm-hmm. think. And I remember when we did the Winneman comics, I bought you these big panels and you drew them in pencil,
mm-hmm.
and then reverse engineered them into computer.
Sure.
And colorized them that way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting to think about. I want to transition sort of from that teenage creative world to the origins of Apple Guy, which I sometimes call Applewood and Beef Guy.
You're not the only one.
By accident. And so what are the origins? This is an unusual, it's a buddy comedy, but like Calvin and Hobbes is about a kid and his pet tiger.
Yeah.
This is about a couple of vegetables. So how did you end up having a buddy comedy in a post-apocalyptic world where humans are gone, but trees are anthropomorphic? Give us the backstory here.
So do you want like the lore of the Apple Guy like world, or do you want like how I came up with
the idea? Let's start with how you came up with the idea.
Okay.
Then we can build it from there. Just sort of you as a creative guy, and then you can fold in the lore.
Yeah, sure.
The world building. Because actually having just just reread your book, the first time I read the hardcover book, you're introduced to a world.
It's, yeah.
I guess, a science fiction world of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it corresponds very much to planet Earth and even Kansas in ways we can discuss.
Right.
It is a science fiction world because it's post-apocalyptic and these trees are talking to each other.
Yeah. So the Apple guy was just like a strip that I spent very little time on.
Mm-hmm.
And the character was just kind of like, I mean, the first comic ever made was a joke about it being a guy with an apple head.
Okay.
Basically. And I kind of thought maybe that would be the only one.
Right.
Did
Beefwood exist yet?
Beefwood did not exist yet. At first it was like strictly like Apple guy just talking like to the audience, the reader.
Mm-hmm.
And there were no other characters. And then, I don't know, I guess I got a little bit of good feedback, you know, and I kept on doing it. And I guess I realized that like comics has tons of anthropomorphic animals. You know, it's almost just as common, like whether it's Garfield or
Mickey Mouse.
Or Mickey Mouse, right, is an anthropomorphic animal. And then I was like, why can't we do anthropomorphic plants? You know, like, I get the appeal of doing the animals, which is it like sort of alienates your audience in a way that makes something sort of inherently funny. You're not sure if you're supposed to take it literally or not, the fact that this is a talking mouse,
right,
you know?
Right.
It's like, this is a stand-in for a person, but it's kind of not. Sometimes they do animal things and sometimes they do people things. And so it's kind of it's just like a fun device to use.
This is an interesting point because I went to a romance novel convention and maybe someday, no, I did an episode a long time ago in season one about romance novels, but women who wrote, like werewolf romance or were panther romance, one of the reasons why they did that is that it just took the pressure off the characters who were having the romance and that they weren't beholden to like human sexual mores,
right?
And so they were usually erotic romance novel writers, and so they could just have really strange sex lives.
Sure.
But they were panthers or werewolves,
right?
So like, why judge them? Because they're animals, right?
Right.
So it feels like this is a weird parallel that in the comedic sense, you can also have fun with anthropomorphic animal. And actually, I love this. Are you aware of any other anthropomorphic plant comics?
I was trying to think about this.
I'll let my listeners do the research, but for the purpose of this interview, let's just say that you pioneered of anthropomorphic plant cartoons or comics. Just because, and this actually plays into it, and just so.
Well, there are ants. There are ants in Lord of the Rings.
The what?
The ants, like the talking trees.
Oh, the talking trees.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Right. I mean, in like folk tales, there's lots of talking trees.
Well, and I think like the druids.
Right.
I mean, and this comes up in your comic.
Right.
You know, the idea of the old spiritual traditions. And I mean, this is how the universe of your comic could continue to go in an interesting direction, just because animistic traditions have, you know, spirits in plants, right?
Right.
And so in a way, as Western industrialized culture becomes more urbanized, that old way of looking at the world.
Mm-hmm.
And how many characters? There's Apple Guy and Beefwood, obviously, but there's also like Fetid Gourd. How many characters are? How many active characters are in the world of your book as it is published?
There's maybe like 6 or 7 characters you see somewhat regularly.
Right.
And then there's a lot of other tangential characters. It's kind of like, you know, George R. R. Martin, like there's actually 2,000 characters that are named, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And making this, you kind of get it. It's like, it's pretty fun to come up with a new character.
Well, it's an interesting comparison to make because even though it's not at all like Game of Thrones, it's kind of like Game of Thrones in that it sort of has its own universe.
Yeah.
You know? So here's a question for you, especially since we're in the context of this comic getting started. is like, what's at stake in this world? What are the obsessions of these characters? Because in Game of Thrones, winter is coming,
right?
And you have these rivals.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's not a lot of violence in Apple Guy. It's sort of about friendship, but there's also some antagonists. There's a very intimidating cashier.
Right.
It's sort of about, the reason I brought up Seinfeld in the intro is that, you know, Seinfeld was famously a show about nothing.
Right.
Which
yeah.
means it's about just the minutia of life. Mm-hmm. But before I sort of talk too much, I'll let you just explain what this world is, what's at stake, what the characters want, what's important to yeah. Apple Guy, Beefwood, and the other characters in this anthropomorphic vegetable world.
And getting back to your prior question about where it kind of comes from, I mean, Apple Guy, that character, is sort of like at the center of this world. He's like, in a lot of ways, he's like having the sort of correct response to life's many problems, if that makes sense.
Well, he's a guy who has a point.
Yeah.
I mean, just like, I immediately thought of, like, a guy comes and says, I'll build a garage.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, what's a garage? And he's like, well, it's like a house for your car. And I think it's Apple Guy who says, but my car is a house. It has doors and windows in it. And there was just something delightfully logical about the fact that why build a house for your car, which is itself a house.
Right. As far as like the world itself, I guess to give you a little bit of a peek behind the curtain, like kind of my idea is that in Apple Guy, like the humans are gone, at least in the United States. And it's a very local, like we don't really get any kind of global sense of a globe. Mm.
The characters they know that humans have once lived here, and no, there's vestiges of the human culture, but there's no humans left, at least in this place.
It's post-apocalyptic for us, you and me.
Right.
It's not post-apocalyptic for the plants.
True.
It's like, fine, you know.
Right. It's not post-apocalyptic for us, but it's post-apocalyptic for the dinosaurs.
Right.
In this moment right
now. Yeah, exactly. Once I got into the swing of it, the sort of central joke in the world building itself was kind of this idea that humans had disappeared.
Mm-hmm. And I have a question about that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a comic that says they were raptured to a yeah. very specific place. Is that true, or is that an unreliable narrator?
We don't know, and I'm not going to tell you.
Okay, so that's a spoiler alert, but actually it's not a spoiler because he's not going to tell us. But the in the world of the story, the humans have been raptured to a very idiosyncratic place that, here's a hint, has the same first fruit name as the protagonist of the comic. But keep going.
So the humans have disappeared. The plants have taken over. But the kind of the central joke is that, like, the plants evolve, and they, because humans have changed the world so much, the plants evolve to meet that changed world. The human world.
Mm-hmm.
And so the plants kind of become human.
Right.
Because cars exist and doorknobs and stuff, the plants evolve to have hands.
Right.
You know, because laptops exist, they have fingers, you know. It's sort of like this reverse engineering. I mean, again, it's not like it's a sort of this fantasy thing.
I was attuned to many travel textures in your book because I'm a travel guy.
Yeah.
And there's one comic where they're just sort of talking about how the prairie doesn't really have many landmarks, and what mm-hmm. to a person in California would just be a really boring hillock would be a major landmark
right.
in Kansas. And so is Apple Guy the one who decides to make the world's tallest pair of blue jeans?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which I think is brilliant. And I'm curious to know where you got the idea, but it's just like, yeah, why not make the world's tallest pair of blue jeans? It could be like a triumphal arch, you know, like monumental architecture, blue jeans. And so I'm curious to know, one, was that inspired by the world's largest belt buckle in Abilene? And two, was it inspired by the fact that Lee Jeans started in Salina, Kansas? Or none of the above?
I think yes, sort of, on number one.
Okay.
No, on number two.
Okay.
I mean, I think I mean, the largest belt buckle is kind of a new thing.
It's in
a
Abilene,
yeah.
Well, I mean, they literally chose it as a tourist attraction.
Right.
That it's like, well, let's build the largest belt buckle in the world, certify it with Guinness, and then have the tourists climb up a tower so they can pose behind the largest belt buckle in the world.
I feel a little bit like they're cheating because is it even made out of like metal?
I have a picture of myself by the world's largest belt buckle, and I think it is made out of metal.
Okay, but okay.
At least it's partially made out of metal.
I mean, there's also the world's largest Czech egg in Wilson,
right,
which is possibly more eccentric than the world's largest belt buckle.
Well, there's the Museum of the World's Smallest Models of the World's Largest Things,
yes,
right?
Right.
So
there's the largest ball of twine in Cawker City.
True. Which is not literally, I think it's the largest ball of sisal twine.
Hand-wrapped sisal twine.
It's the world's largest prairie dog, which it turns out was made of concrete.
I've seen that.
Okay.
It's in South Dakota, I think.
Oh, I thought it was in Western Kansas.
Oh, well, there's another giant prairie dog in South Dakota.
In plains places, they don't naturally have landmarks that people want to stop. You sort of have these, and actually, I think your line is something along the lines of building roadside attractions are all that's left of the American dream. Or that basically, sort of this pioneering spirit of just sort of arbitrarily building something that will attract people's attention is something in this post-human world that is still very resonant for these these vegetable characters.
Yeah. I mean, that's what S.P. Dinsmore, like the Garden of Eden guy.
Right, yeah.
He's like, yeah, I'm building this house to be a roadside attraction, and I'm mummifying myself so that it can be a roadside attraction, so that my wife, who's like 60 years younger than me, can have an income after I pass away.
So our listeners know this is the
Garden. That's the American dream. I mean,
this Kansas, this guy built it, and it's this really crazy, crazy self-made house that sort of rails against the capitalists more than 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And he buried himself in his house. You can still look through a glass of window and see him.
Yeah.
It is very weird. Yeah.
Big inspiration for Apple Guy.
No kidding.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Just that kind of thing. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. No, I think that Kansas as a tourist place is sort of a news of the weird place. Like there's really no, obviously there's no skyscrapers or mountains or oceans. And so you have the Brown versus Board of Education site, you have two to three competing Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz sites. And then you have the vestiges of strange people, you know.
But that's what rocks about Kansas, is that it's never on any, like, screensaver.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, the screensaver, then this is probably going to be a comic at some point.
Okay.
But screensavers, like the like beautiful mountain pictures, or it's like the Great Wall of China, or these stock default screensavers on computers, they've like completely ruined like the surprise of like seeing that, you know.
Right.
They've ruined the sublime.
Well, Marshall McLuhan said that through the act of tourism, we seek things that we've already encountered in another medium.
Hmm.
You know, so you go to you see the Mona Lisa to affirm that it's the Mona Lisa that you've already seen on a coffee cup.
Right.
You know, that you go to the Eiffel Tower or, you know, the Empire State Building to affirm what you've already seen.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a non-screensaver place like Kansas, you're not trying to make it live up to the screensaver. You're just showing up and you're experiencing what you get. You know, if you have a book in my audience and you have it open, turn to page 174 in your hymnal. And so Apple Guy and Beefwood are walking across the prairie, and then is this Goutstock?
Mm-hmm.
He comes up on a four-wheel drive and a side-by-side. He says, "Hey, what are you weirdos doing out here?" Beefwood says, "Apple Guy is teaching me how to find beauty in a desolate landscape." Apple Guy says, "Beefwood is reminding me to love the desolation for the things that are here rather than the things that aren't." And Goutstock says, "I'm here to see if I can get this four-wheeler up to 60 miles an hour." And that felt like it was a perfect encapsulation of actual rural life in Kansas.
Yes.
You have like aesthetes who learn the names of the birds and the plants and realize that actually reading the landscape is
a way of looking for beauty. And I've talked before about how being raised in Kansas has allowed me to find beauty in subtle landscapes all over the world. It's a travel writer superpower. But then you also, you're in Kansas and a guy comes on a side-by-side and he doesn't care about any of it. He just wants to shoot coyotes or whatever. And he's actually pretty helpful. Like our rural neighbors, who sometimes are euphemistically might call redneck, they come up on their side-by-sides, which they want to take to 60 miles an hour. They know a lot about the land, but they're just less interested in it from the scientific, philosophical, theological, existential standpoint. And it feels like that's sort of this dichotomy of the rural world of the characters.
Well, there's something funny. I think the fun thing about doing a comic strip that has a punchline is that like a joke is kind of like a little lesson, you know, as well as being a joke, because it's like, I was thinking about like the parables in the Bible. Like a parable is kind of like, it's like an overview of like a cultural understanding at the time. And then Jesus is like, and here's the twist at the end. You know what I mean?
Right.
And like a joke has the same kind of setup. You know, you're like, you set up the reader or audience or, you know, listener, however you're delivering it. You're reaching sort of an understanding with them. And then at the end, there's a little surprise.
Right.
And in that surprise, there's a little nugget of truth if your joke is really good. And so I think that like there's a lot of little jokes in a place like rural Kansas, where like you have people like you or I, you know, like maybe I'm really into it for the rich biodiversity of the prairie. And, but then everyone, you know, there's lots of people that are just here, and they're just doing their own thing.
Right.
And they're not here intentionally. And that is just as interesting as the reason that you and I are here. And they're just doing their own thing. They're trying to figure out how to have fun in a place that kind of sucks. And anytime that people are trying to have fun in a place that kind of sucks,
right,
you end up, there ends up being a sort of inherent creativity to that. It means that the demolition derby is invented.
Well, you and I, when I drove you to college as a freshman in 2017, we stopped in Montreal and we went to the comic book store Drawn and Quarterly, which is now your publisher. So how did you get from being this kid who wrote for his college newspaper comics to a guy who is an Instagram comic influencer, I don't know, a comic artist, to a person who was approached by Drawn and Quarterly, one of the most renowned and established comics, indie comic publishers, to do a book? Like, how did you build a following and become, if not a professional comics writer, a comic writer of some reputation?
There was a period where I was sort of underemployed. And I was looking for things to do. And making this comic was what I came out on. And I just started posting the, you know, Instagram, love it or hate it, has a relatively okay architecture for reading comics. Because you can swipe, you know, through pictures. Those pictures are compacted into boxes. A comic strip is composed of boxes, of panels, you know.
So a four-panel comic is...
is four swipes, you know. And so it actually kind of works. It's not great in a lot of other ways, in the way that it monopolizes our attention through sort of toxic psychological ways, but... disclaimers aside, I started putting it on there, and somehow, I don't know. There's a very like pretty tight knit, you know, DIY sort of indie comics community on Instagram, and so I was kind of able to get into that and reach a very modest following. I mean, like, I don't... The amazing thing about this book getting published is that I don't have 100,000 followers or anything.
You know how many followers you do have?
Like 5,000 or something.
Yeah. So they found you because it was good and funny.
I guess,
not
yeah.
because they were just trying to glom onto your... Actually, I think sometimes those accounts that have hundreds of thousands of followers, those followers aren't people who buy books. So,
yeah, it seems like that, yeah.
Well, what underpins the creative process of this comic? I mean, we were saying before we started recording that you say that it's, comics are seen as drawing, but it's actually kind of writing. So how do you collect ideas? Where do you get ideas? How does the writing manifest? And how do your ideas find a way from raw inspiration to four panels?
At work, I'd be doing very like manual labor a lot of times, like just stuff that didn't require a lot of thought. And I was able to just kind of, like, a lot of times I would listen to audiobooks mm-hmm. at work, and there'd be like a phrase or something that I thought was funny or interesting or something like that. And I'd, you know, write that down in my notes app. And then I would just kind of like ruminate on that phrase. Like, I knew there was some wording or phrase that I wanted to be in the comic. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of just like, I would think about that and rotate it around and spend quite a bit of time just like writing it and editing until it became this four panel comic, you know, four boxes with kind of like a punchline at the end. You know,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I like the format a lot because there's a lot of rules, you know, you can write whatever you want, but it has to fit in these four boxes. And the rule that I've imposed on myself is that it has to be a little bit funny,
right,
at least.
Right.
You know, I think at a different point, I had dreams of, you know, making a big graphic novel or something like that, that was some epic story or something like that,
mm-hmm.
which maybe someday would be cool. But the great thing about doing a comic strip is that there's a gratification built into it, and it doesn't take 100 pages to get there.
Hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Each little thing, gratification for you and for the reader. And so
set up, payoff, twist.
Yeah, very satisfying.
Mm-hmm. Did you hold yourself to a certain frequency? Do you throw work away?
So I tried to do it once a week, which mm-hmm. is another kind of rule that I set for myself
mm-hmm.
that I found to be helpful, because otherwise you can kind of over-edit, I think, and kind of psych yourself out. Like kind of work yourself into a writer's block.
Huh.
I thought that having a little urgency worked into it. Like, I mean, there's something about a deadline that uh-huh. gives you, I don't know what it is exactly, but you spend a little bit extra time thinking about it or worrying about it in a way that can unlock something.
Uh-huh.
And so having a little self-imposed deadline that also meant like, okay, I have something, you know, I think it's pretty good. I found that a week was a very good amount of time to get a joke that I thought was funny every week
mm-hmm.
without having to have it be obsessing about it, having it be perfect, I guess. Like newspaper comics, they had to do it every day. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So crazy. And so yeah. 90% of them are not funny.
Right.
They're cute a lot of times, but they're not funny.
Right.
I think that with a week, I've found that you can make something that's at least funny to me
mm-hmm.
within a week.
Right.
And not have it turn into some 10-year long, like crazy, you know, masterwork conundrum.
Well, this might take us back to your four pieces of advice.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious about, let's just, number one, be opportunistic. What does that mean?
Well, this book has been the result of being opportunistic as opposed to maybe like idealistic.
Hmm. Explain.
Like everything I've written and made here has been while like doing a full-time, basically, you know, pretty much a full-time job, and finding time for this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think overall for me, and I think maybe for other people as well, they think that they have to maybe quit their job in order to pursue an artistic practice that they want to be more serious.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's, I think that's not always as fruitful as people think it's going to be, because there's a lot of material that you're working with in a job itself. You're talking to people and you're being faced with some of these problems.
Mm-hmm.
It's stressful in ways that you can write about or draw about.
It's true to life, you know, it's right. The frustrations of a day of the job.
Right. And I think that, like, I think being opportunistic for me just meant making it happen. Like trying to put this strip out every week. And just sometimes it wasn't as well drawn as it could be, but that's okay. And sometimes I was doing it on the dining room table, you know, or something like that.
Are you still using electronic tools?
No, I draw it all by hand.
Okay.
Just because I enjoy it more.
Okay.
I like it more. So I guess, I don't know. I think that's for art in general, you just, like, in this day and age, you just have, I think most people, until you're really established, you have to be opportunistic. Otherwise, it's not going to happen.
Number two, give yourself some rules.
That kind of goes back to the format of the comic strip.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's something that if I had no rules for this, it would be way harder rather than easier. Mm-hmm. You know, having relatively strict rules, it has to be four panels.
Right.
It has to be some kind of joke. Has been, man, maybe it's just the way my brain works, but I think putting some blinders basically on yourself,
a constraint
can be actually a really creative process. It can make you more creative rather than less creative.
Well, they say that, like, it's the constraints that make athletes stand out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like the fact that LeBron James shines in basketball is mm-hmm. tied to the fact that the goals are a certain height, the court is a certain width.
Right.
There's five people from each team on the court. Right.
Right.
So your constraint is the four panel format.
Right. And the, you know, even newspaper, the invention of comic strips was just a byproduct of the newspaper itself.
Mm-hmm.
The shape that it is, the way that they look, the mm-hmm. newspaper comic strip. But I think that it leads to some really interesting places, like editing, the writing, having everything fit into a small area has made me much better at writing.
Hmm.
Because I think I would way overwrite everything. And so you're like figuring out how to like change a sentence so that it can fit in a word bubble, you know?
Yeah.
Like, so that it can physically fit on the page.
The word count.
Right, yeah. Like, you're trying to, like, find a different word that's, like, four letters shorter, you know?
Your character can't hold forth for 2,000 words.
Right, and I mean, this is already a pretty wordy comic, so
right.
It goes to show how bad it would be if it wasn't for that constraint.
Well, I mean, this ties in. I was talking to a guest we had the other day. She's an Americana singer, sort of a modern country singer, and she talks about how you can't put detailed language into a lyric. You have
mm-hmm.
to simplify, you
mm-hmm.
know? And so similarly, you have to get all your thoughts into those bubbles and and into the format of the four panels.
And there's an element of timing too, you
mm-hmm.
know. Each panel has to have a job. You have to really figure out what is the job of this panel.
Number three is don't torture yourself. What does that mean?
I guess that's a more philosophical. When I'm doing this, I don't want to be unhappy. I want it to be a fun thing that I do.
Right.
Once it becomes not fun, mm-hmm. I don't want to do it anymore.
Right.
I don't think it's worth doing, actually, if it's not fun.
Hmm.
The whole thing for me with this is not, I feel like there's this sort of cultural idea that your art has to be this torturous thing. I don't think that's how I want to do it. And I think it's off-putting for a lot of people.
Well, I think there's a flip side of that too, that there's the torture genius thing, but there's also like the optimized algorithm chaser too.
Mm.
There's sort of the joyless pursuit of the mass approval online, mm. you know, that you want to up your followers.
Mm.
You wanna, oh, well, you know, this theme is hot this month, so maybe I can get up to 10,000 followers if I do this.
Well, and that is, to me, also sort of torturing yourself.
Yeah, true. Number four, people will find your interest in something interesting.
If you're having a conversation with someone, say they're really, really into antique nails.
Okay, all right.
They collect antique nails. They can, like, tell what year a nail was made just by looking at it. They can tell you when. They can tell an American-made nail from a Taiwanese-made nail.
This is a great example because it's very narrative. It's the what's up with that. It's like, really? Somebody cares this much about nails?
Right. It's like, I don't give a shit about nails.
Right.
But you want to talk to someone. Like, that's an interesting person.
Right.
Even if their interest is extremely not your thing, or even on a fundamental level, boring, there's something interesting about someone who is, for at least a short period of time, there's something very interesting about someone who is just passionate or maybe obsessed with a pursuit, you know. And that's enough. That's on a conversational level, that's enough to hold my attention at least. And this is part of the thing about AI and why I think AI art is not necessarily going to be like something that people are that interested in the long term, at least. Because like when you're looking at a piece of art, you're looking at the person, you know, who made the art.
Interesting.
If there's no person that made it,
right?
If it's just the average of a bunch of people, it's, I don't know. It may be interesting for a couple seconds, but it's not something you would write your PhD paper on. Whereas like the most interesting pieces of art are something to me are like, say like the Garden of Eden, like this one,
meaning in Lucas, Kansas,
this strange, deeply strange piece of folk art that is about, 1800s populism and, but also mostly just about this one guy's weird beliefs.
Right.
That's what the thing is, the art is about. That's enough for me. I find that very interesting.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. I'm recording this outro on my phone because I'm on the road right now. A reminder that Cedar and I are giving out signed copies of our 2015 comic, The Misadventures of Winneman, to the first 10 people who email me at deviate@rolfpotts.com and attach a purchase receipt for Cedar's new book, Apple Guy and Beefwood. Thanks for listening, everyone.